KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
When was it that you decided to sell out the values you've had your whole life in order to be given power by President Trump?
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. faces the Senate.
We'll have the latest on his contentious confirmation hearing for HHS director.
For Wednesday, January 29th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Trump has taken aim at the federal bureaucracy this week.
Ahead, we'll take a close look at the so-called Department of Government Efficiency he's setting up to lead that effort.
DOGE is positioning itself as having far more power than USDS traditionally did in the past, say, three administrations.
We'll also talk to a transgender Space Force officer about what Trump's proposed ban on trans service members means for her.
We have to respond by lacing up our boots and accomplishing the mission that we've been given, because that's what we care about.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. At the signing of the Laken Riley Act on immigration today, President Trump announced plans to establish a 30,000-person facility at Guantanamo Bay for deportation of migrants considered especially dangerous. Trump saying the order would instruct the Department of Defense and Homeland Security to do that work. The measure is his first piece of legislation since starting his new administration. It would allow for detention and possible deportation of those in the U.S. without authorization who are accused of theft or violent crimes, potentially even before they are convicted. As the administration moves ahead with its deportation plans in Florida, Republican leaders are split over how to handle immigration enforcement there. NPR's Greg Allen reports Republican Governor Ron DeSantis is threatening to veto an immigration bill passed by GOP lawmakers.
The bill passed by Florida's legislature increases penalties for immigrants without legal status who commit crimes. It also allocates more money to pay for beds and officers to hold migrants detained by federal authorities. And it would make Florida's agriculture commissioner the state's chief immigration officer. Governor DeSantis says the bill is much weaker than the one he's proposed.
We don't have time for half-baked measures. We've got to be strong. We've got to lead the way when it comes to immigration enforcement.
DeSantis has indicated he'll veto the bill. It's not clear yet whether Republican lawmakers have the votes to override his veto. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Federal workers are being given a choice. Either say by next week you'll resign in September or be prepared to come back to the office. However, even if they take the early out, the language is confusing. The administration is seeking to clarify the, quote, expectation employees be put on administrative leave until their departure. However, the word buyout does not appear in the letter to employees, nor is there an offer that includes any kind of lump sum payment. Meta and the company's chief executive Mark Zuckerberg have paid President Trump $25 million to settle a 2021 lawsuit. As NPR's Bobby Allen explains, Trump filed the suit after he was suspended from Facebook and Instagram in the wake of the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol.
Meta and Zuckerberg agreed to the $25 million payout to Trump after years of fighting the litigation. In his suit, Trump claimed his First Amendment rights were violated when he was booted from Facebook and Instagram. Since, Trump argued, Meta was acting at the behest of lawmakers who wanted Trump removed. But Meta said it pushed Trump off its platforms for violating policies for inciting violence. The settlement is the latest example of Zuckerberg yielding to Trump after years of hostilities. Zuckerberg ended a fact-checking program criticized by Trump supporters and appointed Trump ally Dana White to Meta's board. Before he was elected, Trump wrote if Zuckerberg crossed him, he could be thrown in prison for the rest of his life. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
On Wall Street, stocks slipped slightly today. The Dow was down 136 points. The Nasdaq fell 101 points. You're listening to NPR. A stampede of attendees at a religious event in India has claimed the lives of at least 30 people and left at least twice as many injured. Police there say the festival turned deadly when some of the millions of pilgrims attending the event rushed to dip in the sacred waters where three rivers converge, including the Ganges. Hindus believe a dip in the waters can cleanse them of past sins and will lead to reincarnation. The latest edition of what's known as the nation's report card has been released. NPR's Corey Turner reports it's an important snapshot of how fourth and eighth graders are doing nearly 5 years after the pandemic forced school closings.
The previous results from 2022 reflected some steep declines in student learning, and the hope this time was that 2024 would show a turnaround. In fourth grade math, it did, with scores improving for most students, though they're still not back to pre-pandemic levels. Reading, on the other hand, was rough. Scores continued to fall for both fourth and eighth graders. And the lowest performing students are really struggling, scoring even lower in 2024 than the lowest performing readers did 30 years ago. Other research has shown COVID relief dollars did help students make up some ground. These new data just underscore how much work is left to do. Corey Turner, NPR News.
Tax season is now underway, with the Internal Revenue Service expecting when all its over upwards of 140 million people will file returns by April 15th. And the agency says if you want a faster refund, you should file your taxes electronically. Choose to get a refund via direct deposit, and the IRS says it could come even sooner. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing about the state of housing in America on the After the Fact podcast, available at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact, and the Doris Duke Foundation.
On a Wednesday, it's All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is President Trump's nominee to head the Department of Health and Human Services. And today he faced senators in a contentious confirmation hearing. Kennedy is a former Democrat turned independent presidential candidate turned Trump loyalist. And with that in mind, Democratic Senator Maggie Hassan questioned Kennedy's integrity to do the job.
When was it that you decided to sell out the values you've had your whole life in order to be given power by President Trump?
Kennedy is the leader of the so-called Make America Healthy Again movement. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin and Susan Davis covered the hearing and join me now. Hey there.
Hey, Scott. Hi, Scott.
Selena, I want to start with you, and I have to start with vaccines. Kennedy's advocacy against vaccine mandates and questioning the safety of vaccines is the main reason the opponents say he should not have this job. How did he defend himself?
Well, today he said many times he is not anti-vaccine. He said all his kids are vaccinated. He supports the childhood vaccine schedule. What he said is that he wants good science and he wants to make sure vaccines are safe, which, you know, sounds good, but there is this implication that there isn't good science now, which there is, and that vaccines aren't safe now, which they are. I did not hear him say at any point that he had been wrong with all the past statements that people were running by him. He just tried to walk this tightrope that for decades of urging people to skip vaccinations, despite all that, that wouldn't influence his approach to the job of overseeing federal vaccine policy and recommendations.
But again, he has a very long track record here, so I'm curious what kind of pushback he got when he said that.
Well, Democrats on the committee really hammered him on the way he has profited from his anti-vaccine work, from lawsuits against drug makers, for example, books, speeches. His disclosures that became public this week shows he had has made millions of dollars in this activity. And he's just been also very influential in the anti-vaccine movement. One memorable way this came up in the hearing was when independent Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont brought out posters showing the onesies being sold on the website of Children's Health Defense. That's the group Kennedy is closely affiliated with and used to lead.
One of them is titled Unfaxed, Unafraid. Next one, and they're sold for $26 a piece, by the way. Next one is No Vax, No Problem.
Kennedy responded by distancing himself from the group. He said he didn't control the merchandise they sell. But we should note that they streamed the hearing on that website today.
So I'm going to turn to you and another big political topic. Most of his life, Kennedy has supported abortion rights. He now wants to serve in a Republican administration. How did that issue play at today's hearing?
Probably the sharpest exchange was with Senator Hassan. She noted this contradiction of his lifelong advocacy of body autonomy when it comes to vaccines, but wouldn't commit to viewing abortion under that same autonomy. Kennedy also made it clear in a separate exchange with Republican Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma that on this issue, he would not seek to counter the White House in any way.
I agree with President Trump that every abortion is a tragedy. I agree with him that we cannot be a moral nation if we have 1.2 million abortions a year. I agree with him that the states should control abortion.
A quick note, Scott, that Kennedy does have a condition that affects his voice. Mm-hmm. But in that statement, he went on to say explicitly he serves at the pleasure of the president and he will implement his policies when it comes to abortion. And this is key because Kennedy has faced some skepticism on the right from conservative abortion activists that he could somehow be more of a maverick on this issue. He made it clear that is not going to be the case.
Selena, more broadly, what has Kennedy said his top priorities would be if he is confirmed?
Well, he talked a lot about how President Trump has given him a mandate to get the health of Americans back on track. He said in his generation, he is 71 years old, Americans used to be healthier, and he claimed that they could be healthy again with his out-of-the-box thinking and leadership. He said he would move the focus of scientific research away from infectious diseases like the flu and towards things like the root causes of chronic diseases like diabetes.
A huge part of HHS and its budget is Medicare and Medicaid, also the Affordable Care Act. These are all programs that touch a lot of people's minds and are always politically top of mind. How did Kennedy address those?
So on those topics, at times, Kennedy seemed to not know his way around those issues very well. At one point, he got the word Medicare and Medicaid confused, it seemed like, and he said that they're not popular programs. Well, they're very extremely popular across the political spectrum. And this is an important issue because Republicans in Congress are looking to possibly trim these programs in an effort to balance the budget.
Sue, Republicans have the majority in the Senate. How did Republicans approach Kennedy and navigate his complicated history?
Look, to put a fine point on it, he's been accused for a long time of being a conspiracy theorist, particularly in how he frames this intersection of government and science. One Republican senator, Tom Tillis of North Carolina, seemed to try to give him some oxygen to defend himself.
I got a real quick question for you. Are you a conspiracy theorist? That is a pejorative, Senator, that's applied to me, mainly to keep me from asking difficult questions of powerful interests.
Scott, I don't think you can discount how much the COVID pandemic transformed the way the Republican Party views these government health agencies as almost a hostile force, a view that Kennedy at times has shared, which I think explains why there is so much conservative support for him in this political moment.
Yeah. At this point, there really does not seem to be much resistance at all to Trump's nominees. Is Kennedy on track to be confirmed?
You know, nothing is certain in the Trump administration, but it seems likely. Members of the Kennedy family are out there advocating against him, including his cousin, Caroline Kennedy, the daughter of former President Kennedy. She released a letter this week she sent to senators calling him a, quote, predator and saying he should be defeated. This carries a lot of weight with Democrats, but this is really about keeping the Republican Party unified. He can only lose three Republican senators and still get confirmed if all Democrats oppose him. And I would note here, Scott, that his former running mate, billionaire Nicole Shanahan, publicly this week said she will personally fund primary challenges to any of the key senators who oppose him or threaten to take down his nomination.
That is NPR's Susan Davis along with Selena Simmons-Duffin. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Staying with the federal government, after winning the election, President Trump championed the idea of an outside commission to shrink federal bureaucracy and slash federal spending. Sure enough, on one of his day one executive actions, he created the, quote, Department of Government Efficiency, but inside the federal government. NPR's Stephen Fowler has been following this initiative. Hi, Stephen.
Hey there.
Okay, so this is the DOGE effort, the so-called DOGE effort. It was pitched as an outside review of how the government works, how it might work better, but this executive order sounds a little bit different.
It's pretty different, Mary Louise. As a quick refresher, Elon Musk and others have pitched DOGE as this non-governmental review of the government's spending and workforce and infrastructure to find ways to slim things down. But the executive order has a more, shall we say, efficient mandate for now. I mean, for starters, the core idea of reviewing spending and the DOGE agenda appears to be a temporary organization created inside an existing office. The order also tasks every federal agency with creating a DOGE team that includes a team leader, an engineer, an HR specialist, and an attorney. There's also specific instructions to do a, quote, software modernization initiative to update IT and data infrastructure needs across the federal government.
Okay, you just said the DOGE agenda appears to be A, a temporary organization, and B, inside an existing office in the executive branch. Which one? Where is it?
So it's this little known but widely respected office called the United States Digital Service, which will now be called the United States DOGE Service. Still, the acronym's USDS, which is pretty efficient. It's also not one I'd heard of before, so I called up the most recent administrator, Mina Shung, to help explain.
USDS brings in folks from the private sector who are really good at implementing stuff with technology and partners with government teams to help make government technology implementations work as well as private sector technology implementations.
Basically, after the disastrous rollout of the healthcare.gov website during the Obama administration, this old version of the USDS was created. Huh. It's operated like this elite digital strike team that brings fresh ideas, new technology, and design thinking to the notoriously slow-moving and frustrating bureaucracy of the federal government.
Well, I will confess I have been a journalist in Washington for a number of years now. I had not heard of USDS before. I'm guessing many Americans might be in the same boat. Might we be more familiar with its work?
Well, Mary Louise, if you've interacted with a government website and didn't hate it, chances are the USDS probably had a hand in some part of it. Here's an example. The VA was plagued by long wait times, so the USDS collaborated on an app to make healthcare options more accessible. They partnered with the IRS to pilot a free online digital tax filing pilot program. They even helped boost satisfaction dealing with the Social Security Administration website by making complicated processes and language easier to understand. I mean, put another way, this office has historically used technology to cut down on problems and inefficiencies within the government, saving money while doing so. So there's actually a lot of potential alignment with its past mission and the future vision under Trump.
And what do we actually know about that future vision? Like what they are going to do in this office, how it might operate?
Well, there's not a lot because we are still waiting to see who Trump picks as an administrator and how these DOGE teams are implemented. But to also answer that question, I called Jennifer Palka. She's a senior fellow with the Niskanen Center who also helped create the USDS more than a decade ago. She also says there's not much information out there about the new direction, but it's a normally behind-the-scenes office that is likely to be more in the spotlight.
DOGE is positioning itself, and we'll see if this really plays out, as having far more power than USDS traditionally did in the past, say, three administrations.
Now, Palka said that power could be used to push federal agencies towards having better systems in place to achieve policy goals and serve the American people. But she also cautioned that those changes would only be successful if DOGE collaborates with federal agencies to find projects instead of focusing on just saving money.
And here's Stephen Fowler in Atlanta. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow. President Trump has once again ordered a ban on transgender troops in the military. Trump issued a similar order early in his first presidency. President Biden removed it. But on Monday, Trump issued an executive order starting the process of putting it back in place. The newly sworn-in Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, now has 30 days to submit a plan to put the order into effect. For more on this, we are joined by Colonel Bree Fram of the U.S. Space Force. She is one of the highest-ranking transgender service members in the armed forces. She's also the former president of SPARTA, an advocacy group for transgender service members and veterans. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Scott.
I should say right off the top, you're here in your personal capacity, but you're still in the military, you're still active duty. And I have to start with this. What does this mean for you?
What this means for me and so many transgender service members is that we're back where we've been before, and we're dealing with a government policy that says we in some way shouldn't be part of the military. Yeah. Our values don't align with the military. And that's a huge challenge because we've had over almost a decade of open service where we have proved as transgender service members that we meet or exceed the standards the military has.
I would like to, if it's all right with you, read a few lines from this order and talk to you about it because it gets to what you just said. And I don't want to take it out of context, so I'm gonna read a couple sentences here. Consistent with the military mission and longstanding DOD policy, expressing a false gender identity divergent from an individual's sex cannot satisfy the rigorous standards necessary for military service. Skimming a few sentences here and picking back up, a man's assertion that he is a woman and his requirement that others honor this falsehood is not consistent with the humility and selflessness required of a service member. And I wanted to read that because you are a high-ranking officer in the Space Force. This is an agency that Trump created. You are helping shape it in its early years. And he is saying, he's essentially saying that you don't belong, that you can't be trusted. What is your response?
Scott, I am so excited to be a member of the United States Space Force. Our mission to protect and defend our assets on orbit, to support the joint force, is so important to me. It is a part of my core being. So to have my service and the service of thousands of others basically invalidated is a challenge. But how do we respond? Well, we have to respond by lacing up our boots and accomplishing the mission that we've been given.
So you personally are responsive saying, you know what? I've been here for two decades, and this is the message. I'm going to figure out a way to do something else with my career. That's not an option for you. You're going to keep doing your job.
Scott, I'm a rocket scientist. I know hot air when I see it, and I understand that it can fill the space that it is allowed to take up.
Yeah.
And so when arguments are made that we are somehow broken or incapable, all we can do is point to the evidence that shows otherwise.
I want to get your response to one more line that we've been hearing as the president has issued this order, many other executive orders, that this is the commander-in-chief, this is the head of the executive branch. Whether you agree or disagree, he has the right to make a decision and put a policy in place. I mean, that is a broad concept that is key to the military as a whole. How do you think about that on this very personal, particular issue?
That's absolutely true. The president has the ability to put policies in place, as does the Secretary of Defense. Again, though, we swear an oath to the Constitution. That is the backbone of our service. And we will do the best we can, given the circumstances.
I wanted to ask, looking over your bio, I noticed that your co-lead on the United States Department of the Air Force's LGBTQ plus initiatives team. Today, does that team still exist?
That team no longer exists as of last week, so I am the former co-lead of that team.
You know, we talked to you when you were in the Air Force before you went to the Space Force. The first time President Trump issued an order along these lines, and we interviewed your wife as well, and she expressed big concerns. What are the conversations like at home right now?
The conversations at home are those of uncertainty. Yeah. We just don't know what's in store for us. And that's a huge challenge. It affects families. It affects kids. And so many transgender service members, just like any other service member, have those families and those considerations. So we have to think about it, but face what's right in front of us and make decisions on the best information that we have at the time.
Have you had conversations with your kids about the content of this order and the message that it sends?
I certainly have. Yeah. My kids are old enough to know what's going on at 16 and 12, and they see these things happening, and they worry about me. And so it's a difficult time to have that talk with your kids when your kids are worrying about you, when normally it should be my job to worry about them and what I can do. So it breaks my heart a little bit to have to see my kids go through this.
That is Colonel Bree Fram of the U.S. Space Force. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
The Mona Lisa is set to be moved out of the biggest gallery at the Louvre Museum in Paris and into its own dedicated space. French President Emmanuel Macron's announcement this week is aimed at managing crowds. It could also benefit the other artworks that for decades were forced to share a room with the world's most famous painting. NPR's Chloe Veltman has more.
The Salle des États at the Louvre is packed with Venetian Renaissance masterpieces like The Wedding Feast at Cana by Paolo Veronese.
Look at this. Oh, perfect.
The Hipster Travels TikTok team posted this video about the artwork in 2023. It depicts a famous biblical scene in which Jesus miraculously turns water into wine.
I have goosebumps everywhere.
The painting is hard to miss. Colourful, busy and enormous. But most of the Louvre's roughly 9 million annual visitors just rush by. They're only interested in what's hanging on the opposite wall.
People are just coming to check their iPad visit to the Mona Lisa box.
Suleiman Bachir Diagne is a professor of French and philosophy at Columbia University who's given lectures on the Louvre's art collection on behalf of the museum.
And even if you go to that room with the intention of looking at the other paintings, you would be distracted by everything happening around the Mona Lisa.
Speaking at the Louvre on Tuesday, French President Emmanuel Macron said moving Leonardo da Vinci's painting out of the Salle des États would help visitors connect with the room's many neglected masterpieces by artists like Veronese, Titian and Tintoretto.
Nous pourrons enfin revoir les chefs-d'œuvre de la Salle des États.
Collège de France professor and 2024 Louvre writer-in-residence Antoine Compagnon was present at the museum for Macron's speech. He says he's all for putting the Mona Lisa in its own special room.
It will free the Salle des États.
The Paris resident says in the meantime he loves visiting that room on Tuesdays when the Louvre is closed to the public. He can hang out with his favourite painting, Titian's Man with a Glove, without all of the jostle and noise.
There is a sort of melancholy that translates in the representation of this young man.
And Compagnon adds, taking time with the canvas allows the eye to be drawn to details, like the glove's delicate beige colour. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
A woman is a so-called dreamer brought to the United States as a child. Now that she's grown up and a mother, she asks what happens if deportations pull her family apart.
Will he remember me? If I'm gone, when I see him again, is he still gonna hug me? Is he still gonna smile when he sees me? I don't want to think about these things, but I do.
A Family Prepares, tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Christy DeShiel is up for a Grammy, her first ever nomination.
Ahead, we talk to the jazz singer about how a particular space can bring out a feeling or a song.
The room is really reverberant, and for me, a singer, like, that's like heaven, because my voice sounds so pretty in here, because it just goes everywhere.
First news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The White House has rescinded its effort to pause trillions of dollars in federal spending. NPR's Windsor Johnson tells us it comes a day after a federal judge blocked it.
President Trump's order fueled a long-running legal debate over Congress's authority to determine how taxpayer dollars are spent. Jed Sugarman, a law professor at Boston University, says the president's memo amounted to an unconstitutional power grab.
Congress has already spoken to this in a statute called the Impoundment Control Act, specifically address whether the president tries to block or pause. The president can't do either.
The Impoundment Control Act limits a president's authority to refuse to spend or commit to spending funds appropriated by Congress. The White House had argued that the order did not constitute a funding freeze and was not subject to the law. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
On Capitol Hill, Democrats confronted Robert F. Kennedy Jr. today, President Trump's choice to run the Health and Human Services Department, during his first of two confirmation hearings about his past controversial statements on vaccines. Here's Oregon Senator Ron Wyden.
The receipts show that Mr. Kennedy has embraced conspiracy theories, quacks, charlatans, especially when it comes to the safety and efficacy of vaccines. He has made it his life's work to sow doubt and discourage parents from getting their kids life-saving vaccines.
Kennedy claims he's not anti-vaccine, instead describing himself as pro-safety.
I'm not here because I want a position or a job. I have a very good life and a happy family. This is something I don't need. I want to do this because we're going to fix it.
This is NPR. President Trump keeps repeating his desire to buy the strategic Arctic territory of Greenland, which is part of Denmark and not for sale. Even if it were, Trump could face a competing claim from one of America's closest allies, as NPR's Lauren Freyer reports.
In 1917, when the U.S. signed a treaty recognizing Denmark's claim to Greenland, Britain was involved too, because Canada, Greenland's closest neighbor, was British back then. Tom Hoyam is a former Danish official and Greenland expert who says Britain made its own claim during those treaty talks, that if Denmark ever sold Greenland,
then the United Kingdom had the first right to buy it or to be consulted.
Any British right of first refusal is not in the 1917 treaty, and the UK government tells NPR it has no plans to exercise it. But technically, if Trump wants to buy Greenland, he might have to ask Britain first. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
In the Middle East, more hostages are expected to be released tomorrow as the ceasefire in Gaza continues to hold. Israel says eight hostages, including five Thai nationals, will be freed in its prisoner exchange with Hamas. Seven Israeli captives, including four soldiers, have so far been released in exchange for 290 Palestinian prisoners. On Wall Street, stocks finished lower after the Fed held steady on its key interest rate today. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments,
As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Today at the White House, President Trump touted his recent efforts to remake the federal government, including calling on federal workers to return to the office. He also defended his administration's attempt to pause and review federal loans and grants.
We are merely looking at parts of the big bureaucracy where there has been tremendous waste and fraud and abuse.
Mara Liasson joins us from the White House to parse through the administration's moves today. Hey, Mara.
Hi, Scott.
All day, there was so much confusion about whether this freeze was unfrozen, about the state of scores of federally funded programs. There were conflicting messages from the administration minute to minute. But what was the bigger political picture here?
The bigger political picture is that the White House had put a temporary but very broad freeze on federal spending, and they were challenged in court, and a judge put a pause on Donald Trump's spending pause. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't clear what exactly was going to impact. But what the White House says now is just because this broad freeze has been rescinded, it doesn't mean that the president isn't still going to try to cut federal spending. The bigger debate is about Donald Trump's very expansive, some people would say authoritarian, view of presidential power. He doesn't believe the presidency should be constrained by constitutional checks and balances, including those in Article 1 that says Congress gets to decide how money should be raised and spent. And those clashes are going to continue because he believes that some of the checks and balances on presidential power, like the impoundment law that says presidents can't not spend money that Congress has voted to spend, he believes that's unconstitutional.
And that, of course, would be a fundamentally different approach to federal governing.
Fundamentally different, yeah.
Like we mentioned, the president did address all of this today. He was speaking at the signing of immigration legislation at the White House. Tell us about that event.
Right. He signed a bill that fulfills his promise to prioritize cracking down on illegal immigration. It expands the scope of who can be arrested, detained, and deported. It passed with bipartisan support. Democrats, including President Biden, came very late to understand how important border security was to voters. Mm-hmm. The law is named for Laken Riley, a young woman who was killed by an immigrant in the United States without legal status. And this really is Trump's most original theme. Ever since he rode down the golden escalator in 2015 talking about Mexico sending rapists, he has surrounded himself with the families of people who've been harmed by immigrants without legal status. And this is an issue that he really won in the 2024 election. The majority of people agree with him that immigrants who commit crimes should be deported.
Let's go back to this funding freeze, what comes next, the way that Trump is talking about that. We have all of that confusion. You have the halt put in place by the federal judge. The administration seems to walk it back, does walk it back today, for now at least. Still, though, would you call today a political success for Trump?
Absolutely. He also announced, by the way, he made some news. He says he's asking the military to prepare a 30,000-bed detention center at Guantanamo Bay to house migrants who are being deported. But this was a real Trump day. All the familiar themes. He's in perpetual campaign mode. He started out his remarks with a lot of false statements. He said that he won the election by millions and millions of votes. Actually, he won by 1.5 million. He had many, many negative things to say about federal workers. He says most of the time they're not working. He said most of them have other jobs. He says most of them haven't been in the office for years. They haven't worked. So these are, you know, faceless federal bureaucrats, and people here without legal status are easy to demonize. And I think he would say, I was elected as a disruptor. I said I'd deport a lot of immigrants, and I am. I said I would cut the federal workforce, and I'm doing that too. And I think he would consider this very, very successful.
Said PR's senior national political correspondent, Mara Liasson. Mara, always good to talk to you.
Thanks. Russia was a key ally to Syria for decades, propping up its economy and its military. Russia also helped Bashar al-Assad fight the very rebels who now control Syria after toppling the regime last month. But with Russian bases still active on Syrian soil, the question is, what's the next move for Syria's interim government? NPR's Hadil al-Shalchi paid a rare visit to Russia's army base in Latakia and brings us this report.
There's a large picture of President Vladimir Putin looming over the entrance of the Khmeimim Russian airbase in Latakia on the Mediterranean coast. Five armed Russian soldiers, a couple of them masked, mill around in front of the main guard post. They smoke and laugh. We've got to get out of here, brother, one says. Where do you want to go? A short while later, about a dozen military vehicles roll out of the base, the Russian flag flying on the dashboards. They're carrying bombs, heavy equipment, and other military supplies. Abul Yamam is the Syrian rebel who coordinates the Russian convoy's movements. It depends, he says. Some mornings they go out two or three times. The Khmeimim base was built in 2015 in a village of the same name. From here, the Russians helped Bashar al-Assad fight opposition forces in his 13-year civil war. Those rebels, led by Hay'at Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, toppled Assad last December. And Russia has been slowly clearing out. Some of the supplies leaving Khmeimim are going to Russia's naval base in Syria, in the port of Tartus, 30 miles away. From there, some supplies are shipped to Russian bases in Africa. Last week, Syrian media reported that HTS ended a 49-year contract with a Russian company that controlled the port of Tartus. The naval base will still remain, but Joshua Landis says HTS may be sending a message by terminating that contract. Landis is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma.
This is a new day. We're doing things in a new way. We have switched our allegiances.
Landis says not to make too much of it, though.
Syria is going to have to cut off relations for the short term. But that doesn't mean that they won't return and make up with Russia.
HTS wants to be taken seriously, internally and internationally. And there's one way to do that.
When you look at today, where can it go? Who can it get arms from? Who's going to rebuild their army?
Landis says help from Turkey and Qatar, who funded HTS during the war, isn't enough. And leaning on the United States comes with its own complications. The U.S. still has sanctions on Syria, whose neighbor Israel is Washington's closest ally in the region and has been officially at war with Syria for almost 70 years.
But ultimately, if they come to the United States, they've got to make peace with Israel and align themselves with the pro-Israeli lobby in Washington.
That leaves Russia, the very country that bombed them. And Russia seems ready to cooperate.
We должны подумать над этим, потому что
Putin recently told reporters that Russia is reflecting on its relations with Syria and that HTS was receptive. The naval base at Tartus is a vital strategic interest to the Russians, their only hold in the Mediterranean. HTS didn't respond to NPR's request for comment. The soldiers at the base stroll away from their guard post to buy candy and soda at a nearby shop. The store sign is in Russian, like all the other shops in the village. And while the world waits to see how HTS will relate to its once sworn enemy, for now, the Russians are still propping up the economy in this small corner of Syria. Hadil al-Shalchi, NPR News, Latakia.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. For the past few years, Americans applying for a passport could choose male, female, or X as their gender marker. But President Trump has taken that third option away, and Secretary of State Marco Rubio has now suspended all applications of Americans who did not pick male or female. It's a move that is likely to be challenged in court, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman explains.
The offices of Lambda Legal have been getting lots of questions from trans and non-binary people across the country worried about the status of their passports.
Everything is just like being put to the side. And this is very disconcerting, to say the least, for people who have imminent international travel plans.
That's Carl Charles, who's with Lambda Legal.
The State Department is not processing any requests for an X gender marker, nor are they processing any gender marker updates for binary markers. That is, for someone looking to change their gender marker from M to F or from F to M, those are also not being processed.
Charles predicts there will be legal challenges. Lambda Legal represented the first person to receive a gender X passport, Dana Zim, who's intersex, and that took years of litigation.
We had to litigate Dana's case for 6 years, through the end of the Obama administration, into the Trump 1 administration, and that was not even resolved until 2021, when Dana finally secured an X gender marker on their passport.
In 2022, the Biden administration decided to allow Americans to choose how they identify when filling out their passport applications. Thousands of gender X passports are believed to be in circulation now, though the State Department won't give any numbers. Carl Risch was the head of consular affairs during the previous Trump administration and says he lobbied to get rid of the gender marker altogether, like it was before the 1980s.
And getting passport adjudicators out of the middle of being the gender police.
Now a partner at a D.C. law firm, Risch says he doesn't think the Trump administration will want to do that because this issue plays well to Trump's base.
And I think they find this to be politically useful, so I'm not certain they would be open to that kind of sort of pragmatic compromise around resolving this once and for all so that we don't have to deal with the litigation and the fighting amongst ourselves about what kind of gender marker should be available on a passport.
Charles of Lambda Legal thinks that's the point of this, to create fear among transgender and non-binary Americans who make up less than 1% of the population and a tiny fraction of passport holders. The State Department is now warning such travelers that many countries don't recognize the gender X markers, but Charles points out that other countries have had them for years.
Australia, Austria, Bangladesh, Canada, Germany, Iceland, India. Nationals from those countries are traveling all over the world with these documents, and there have not been issues.
For now, existing U.S. gender X passports remain valid, but Trump's State Department is not answering many questions about this, raising concerns for those who are waiting on their travel documents. They might have to reapply and get a passport with a gender marker that is not accurate or does not reflect how they look, creating more troubles at international borders. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Today, we continue our series about this year's first-time Grammy nominees. And we're going to start this one on top of a hill in suburban Maryland, north of Washington, D.C., where a wealthy couple had a summer home built around 1899. Now, by summer home, I mean a mansion. That's what it's called today, the mansion at Strathmore. And Strathmore, it's now a performing arts center that surrounds the home. And it's here, in a dark, wood-paneled room that seats about 100 people, that jazz vocalist Christy Dashiell says she first felt like an artist.
I remember just being an artist that knew I had something to say, but I didn't have the sort of space to say it, and I didn't really know how to get what I was saying out.
More than a decade ago, Christy Dashiell came to Strathmore for its Artist in Residence program. She was one of six musicians just launching their careers. And so, it felt like the right move when she was putting out her first album to come right back to this room for the release concert.
I think when I walked in the room and there were people in the room clapping for me and cheering for me and smiling at me when I was singing, I knew, oh, this is for real. Like, I'm doing the artist thing for real.
Yeah, for real. Christy Dashiell's second release is called Journey in Black, and it's up for a Grammy for Best Jazz Vocal Album.
I'm trying to remember it.
I know
she and I spoke while she sat at the beat-up Steinway Grand Piano inside the music room of the mansion at Strathmore, a room that has just amazing acoustics.
The room is really reverberant, so the sound just really fills the space. And for me, a singer, like, that's like heaven, because my voice sounds so pretty in here, because it just goes everywhere.
But
oh, I love the way you put that. When you did the residency program at Strathmore, how much did it open your eyes to different types of musical collaboration? I mean, I ask because I sort of picture an experience where you're meeting and mixing with all kinds of musicians and artists, and you're learning from each other, challenging each other. Was it kind of like that?
It was. I think I was just coming out of grad school where I studied jazz voice. And then, you know, before grad school, I had studied jazz voice for 4 years at Howard. And so coming out of that space, I was just like a jazz head. I wanted to sing like Ella. I wanted to sing like Sarah. I wanted to sing standards, and just, I wanted to really fit into that space. And I wanted to fit into that space so bad, but there was something in me that knew that wasn't exactly the space that was for me.
Dear brother, I feel your pain.
And now you teach at Howard, right, in D.C., where you studied, as you mentioned. And I understand your father also teaches in the music department at Howard. Is that right?
That's right. My father is the chair of the music department at Howard. And at first, I hated it.
Well, I was going to ask, what is that like having your dad in charge there?
It was weird. Well, my dad has always been in charge. So it's like, okay, we're back.
Right. Yeah.
I'm embracing it now. At first, my family is really musical. My dad is a bass player. My siblings play. Actually, my brother is on my album. And I grew up with that being just how things were. 5 years into my teaching at Howard, my dad was like, I'm going to be your boss now. At first, I was really resistant. I was like, I don't want this. This is what I was trying to get away from. But now, you know, it's great. It's like, who gets the chance to be like, I get to go to my dad's office and have lunch, you know, every day. And we get to talk about music and educating and how to help students find their voice like my teachers helped me. So I'm learning to lean in a little bit more to that.
For today's a new song. Yesterday's come and gone.
Well, this album is called Journey in Black. Can you tell me the journey you wanted to take people on? Because the very first track is called Ancestral Folk Song. Why start the journey there?
I really wanted to honor my two grandmothers, both of which passed away around the COVID lockdown time.
Oh, wow.
My husband's grandmother passed, and my maternal grandmother passed almost about a year apart. And I really wanted to spend time writing a lament, but also writing a song that was in honor of them. And then it turned into me just kind of honoring the ancestors that made the music. It just kind of snowballed into a bigger thing.
Yeah.
And I also knew that I wanted people to know that jazz music is our folk music too. So I thought, okay, ancestral folk song, cool.
Well, then this record, it explores such a wide range of emotions, right? You have love, you have grief, you have joy, you have a broken friendship. How intentional was that to give this album such an expansive emotional wingspan?
Wow, thank you for saying that. I wanted Journey in Black to, while the title is black is kind of a central word in the title, I wanted to open up what black looks like and means to people. So often I find I lead my life with, I'm a black woman and this is my black experience, which is incredibly true. And also sometimes that blocks me from experiencing things more from a human space. And I think the human themes of love, loss, grief, joy, friendship, all of us can relate to that, black, white, brown, whatever.
So where were you when you got the news that you were nominated for your first Grammy?
I wish I could bottle that feeling up and just hold it. But I was at home. I had just performed in Philly the night before. I was on that first train smoking that Friday morning that I found out, because I was like, I got to get home. I got to be with my husband. I got to be with my dog. They're announcing the Grammy nominations. I think I could be nominated, but also I think I could not be nominated. So let me be home. And I was on my couch, and then my name came on the screen, and I was like, I was just shocked. I was shocked. It was a great feeling.
Christy Desshiel's album, Journey in Black, is nominated for Best Jazz Vocal Album. And tomorrow, another first-time Grammy nominee, we hear from Radhika Vakharia, who's made a recording of Ancient Chants.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Kresge Foundation, established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and culture.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.